You may think the war of ideas between red and blue America is a relatively recent development, but according to journalist and newspaper columnist David Sirota, the conservatives won way back in the 1980s. In his new book, Back to Our Future, Sirota says the unprecedented media conglomeration of the 80s essentially built the framework for a conservative point of view, a template we still use today. Sirota says the proof is in the staying power of 80s pop culture. He told Steve Paulson about one example, the hit sitcom Family Ties.
Well, it came out in the middle of a larger war in the 1980s to redefine the 1960s. Ronald Reagan was very focused on this. I mean, Ronald Reagan was an anti-60s culture warrior in the 1960s as the governor of California berating the hippies and the protesters at Berkeley. And he carried that forward into the 1980s, constantly making reference to going back to a more idyllic time, a time before the 1960s. And Family Ties, most of the comedy pivoted off of Alex, the kind of aspiring yuppie, making fun of his parents' 60s idealism as either unrealistic or outdated.
Alex, don't you ever worry about the fact that there are enough bombs in the world to destroy every living creature and wipe out life as we know it?
Hey, I got bigger things on my mind. Can I use the business section here, Mom?
Thanks.
Maybe we can just tell Matt he's one of the neighbor children.
It's just so predictable, that's all. Every time one of these ex-hippies comes prancing in from yesteryear, we gotta get out the love beads. Put on the ponchos. Pretend we care about people. I'm just a little too old for that stuff.
And again, this was part of a larger narrative in the culture, everything from the Big Chill to news outlets portraying the 60s in documentaries as sort of just a ridiculous time of unrealistic decadence among the hippies, magazine covers asking, when are we going to get over the 60s? And there's a political message involved in that, right? The political message is that all of the progress, the political progress, the liberal political progress that came out of the 1960s is something that was supposedly bad. And this was happening at the same time that the 1950s were being glorified as an ideal, that what was written out of the 80s version of the 50s, which still sticks with us today, is that the 50s wasn't a time of racial inequality, it wasn't a time of gender inequality, it wasn't a time of religious bigotry, it was supposedly just a time of great national unity. These themes, the bad 60s and the good 1950s, which are really the 80s version of the 50s and the 80s version of the 60s, still define our politics very much today. You see Tea Partiers today say that we should go back to the 1950s because things were better than that. And every presidential election that comes along, the Democrats are berated as supposedly too close to the 60s liberalism and 60s protesters.
So getting back to the popular culture of the 80s, we've talked about Family Ties, this hugely popular sitcom would seem to have had kind of conservative values. Were the writers and producers of Family Ties conservatives? I mean, were their politics conservative?
No, not at all. In fact, Gary David Goldberg, who was the creator of the show, was himself a hippie. And I asked him about this, and he said, well, look, first you have to remember that it is true. It should be acknowledged that Alex was also being made fun of in some sense. But he also said that they didn't design it to berate the 60s. They designed it to meet the audience where the audience already was. There was a fascinating story he told me about how the show changed before it was actually launched for its first year, that they did a pilot or two. And the show was supposed to be about primarily about the parents, and the kids were kind of going to be side characters. And they showed it to an audience. By the way, the audience was an overflow audience from When Joanie Met Chachi, which is a Happy Days spinoff, which was all about glorifying the 50s. So this overflow audience responds mainly to Alex.
Now, another big cultural touchstone of the 80s was the A-Team. Mr. T, of course, still has some traction today. How do you read this culturally and politically?
Well, the A-Team fits into an entire genre of shows that portrayed the government as either inept or evil. You had the Dukes of Hazzard, you had all the detective shows, you had the shows about the cops going rogue against the inept police establishment. The A-Team was a distilled version of this, of all of these themes. And you think about the beginning of the A-Team, what it's saying to the audience. It's saying that first, our heroes are unduly incarcerated. They then promptly escape from a government that can't even do the basic job of incarcerating them. And they have to go out and solve society's problems where the government refuses to solve those problems or can't solve those problems. And the main enemy to evade in the A-Team is the government itself.
In 1972, a crack commando unit was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-Team.
This all sounds funny, and it's not exactly a critically acclaimed show. And some people say, well, why don't you have a sense of entertainment? And I certainly do. Look, I love the A-Team. I watch the A-Team all the time. But remember, the A-Team is one of the most popular shows among preteens, kids age 2 to 11. And what I argue in the book is that regardless of the motive of the creators of the A-Team, the A-Team, the Dukes of Hazzard, so many of these shows were being delivered to children at a time that they were forming the stories through which they would see their world. And so it's not really a surprise that the children of the 80s who were told, hey, the government's inept and the government is evil in so many different media, the A-Team, the Dukes of Hazzard, Knight Rider, the Ghostbusters, it's not surprising that that same generation has grown up and been more amenable to the modern-day political argument that the government is either inept or evil.
You also mentioned the Ghostbusters as part of this phenomenon as well. I guess I hadn't thought of that as being an anti-government movie series, but I suppose it is in a way.
Again, think about what the story of the Ghostbusters is. There's basically a terrorist attack on New York City, an interdimensional terrorist attack by ghosts. The police and the military can't deal with it, and so they have to hire the private contractor.
Are you troubled by strange noises in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread in your basement or attic?
Have you or any of your family ever seen a spook, specter, or ghost?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your phone and call the professionals. Go, Ghostbusters! Our courteous and efficient staff is on call 24 hours a day to serve all your supernatural elimination needs.
We're ready to believe you!
The whole humor in the movie, or at least part of it, is that they're not only the private contractors, but they're for profit. I mean, Peter Venkman, half of his humor is about how much money they're going to make in doing this. And there are analogs to this, obviously, when you think about our reliance now on private contractors, on the idea that the private corporation can be the savior. In fact, there's a line in Ghostbusters, just a really powerful line, where at the beginning where they're starting out and they're working in the university and they get kicked out of the public university. And one of the Ghostbusters, or before they become the Ghostbusters, he said, you know, I like the public sector because I've worked in the private sector, and in the private sector, they expect results. Well, what's the message there? That the public sector expects no results whatsoever. Everybody in the public sector is just lazy and doesn't expect results. And it's funny, but again, a generation that's brought up on these themes, it's not surprising that that same generation is more open to, for instance, the assault, the attack on public workers today. Not so surprising that that generation hasn't flinched as much when we hear that our wars are being primarily or in part run by private military contractors.
Now, there's another movie that was very big in the 80s, Wall Street, starring Michael Douglas. And it would seem that this would be a different story because it was very critical of the Michael Douglas character. I mean, famously, who said greed is good. And, it turned out he was corrupt, trying to bilk people out of their money. What do you see the politics there?
Wall Street is really interesting because it tells us what the 80s had become by the time it came out toward the end of the 80s, that Wall Street was a commentary, Oliver Stone's commentary, lamenting the greed is good ethos. And that greed is good speech was based on an actual speech by Ivan Boesky, the investor.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, For love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA.
Michael Douglas, who played Gordon Gekko, said, you know, people would come up to me who were working on Wall Street in the 90s and in the 2000s and say how much they loved Gordon Gekko. And I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, you know, they would say that they loved the character, not that they loved the lament, but that they saw Gordon Gekko as a hero. And so out of the 1980s comes this idea, even in movies that are supposed to be concerned about this, criticizing this, is the idea of the American dream means greed is good. And this is substantiated, by the way, by empirical data. One data point that's just really telling, in the year-to-year survey of college freshmen that has been done for, I think, 30 years or so, at the beginning of the 1980s, most college freshmen said that they were going to college to develop a meaningful philosophy of life. By the end of the 1980s, the top goal of college students, when they said, why are you going to college, was to make a lot of money. And these numbers have stayed where they are all the way through to today since the 1980s. So there was a formative change in the 1980s in how we define the American dream. The American dream went from a middle-class dream to a dream of great wealth and the idea that greed is really good. The 1980s, when let's specifically talk about greed and money, the way we know we continue to tell ourselves that story is that that has been the basic parameters of our political debate even after the Wall Street meltdown. The Wall Street Reform Bill that was supposed to have changed Wall Street after the greed is good ethos basically drove our economy into the ground, the Wall Street Reform Bill basically stipulated that we can't really or we shouldn't really change that fundamental principle on Wall Street. It was a very, very weak bill, and the debate about it in Congress and throughout the country as well, we only want to tweak the system just a little bit after that principle of greed is good got us into such trouble. And so the lament of the book is that we need to start changing the stories that we started telling ourselves in the 1980s and that we keep telling ourselves today.
David Sirota is a radio journalist and political analyst. He's the author of Back to Our Future. Steve Paulson spoke with him.